This is Jay Barris of Sidley Austin with the Mutual Fund Minute. We're delighted to have with us SEC Commissioner Hester Peirce, who has been sharing her views on SEC regulation and the regulatory process. We're going to pick up where we left off in the last episode, but before we do, Commissioner, can you please remind us of your customary disclaimer?
Well, Jay, thanks for having me here. It's great to be here. I will start with my disclaimer, which is that my views are my own views as a commissioner, not necessarily those of the SEC or my fellow commissioners.
Well, some months ago, the commission published a proposed safeguarding rule, which would replace the custody rule that applies to registered investment advisors who keep assets of customers. In the interim, you had the commission approving the Bitcoin ETFs, which now invest in spot Bitcoin. How does that change the analysis and the way the commission might look at the safeguarding rule?
I don't know if it will affect that rule specifically. Again, that's one that's, we put out a proposal and we got a lot of comment related to crypto, but related much more broadly to other, to all aspects of the rule. I think that's a rule we need to take great care in finalizing. I would benefit myself from having more comment. So I think we could go out for comment again and we could benefit from that. But we'll see what happens with that.
So the next topic really is, I'll put it under the category of how we doing, meaning referring to the Howey case. That's the 1946 Supreme Court case of SEC versus Howey that governs how we analyze whether a particular asset is a security. And that has become very relevant in the crypto area. And in a public statement that you made a couple of years ago, you and Commissioner Roisman stated that in determining whether the federal securities laws should apply to particular digital assets, the Howey test is helpful, but often the application of the test is not exactly crystal clear, especially in the case of digital assets. Is Howey, has it outlived its usefulness? Do we need a new test, or and if so, what would that be?
I wouldn't say that Howey has outlived its usefulness. It's the Supreme Court helping us to understand one element of the definition of security, an investment contract. I do think that the application in the crypto space has been somewhat strained, and I think if we applied similar logic to other types of assets, it would lead to some very strange results, and that's why I guess I would urge us to apply more precision in our application of the Howey test, and you know, I would argue that we should not try to stretch it in ways that we wouldn't do in other areas.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about chief compliance officer liability. In the past, you've spoken about how important it is to think carefully when imposing liability on a chief compliance officer of an investment advisor or a fund. And you said it's now just a couple of years, but you talked about the need to define the parameters of personal liability for compliance officers. I wanted to focus on that. Is there more the commission can be doing to define those parameters for personal liability? Because chief compliance officers are always facing potential liability and are always concerned about it, and often the lines are not clear.
There's absolutely more we could do. We could put out a framework that would outline when we think liability for chief compliance officers is the right thing to do. Chief compliance officers play a very important role in our regulatory framework. We rely on chief compliance officers to help registrants comply with a very complicated set of rules. And so we want to empower chief compliance officers to get the resources they need to do their jobs well and to have the authority they need to do their jobs well. There are times when liability for a CCO makes sense. You have cases where the CCO is herself involved in perpetrating a fraud. I don't think anyone would dispute that liability would be appropriate there. You have instances where a CCO is actively destroying documents or misleading examiners, no one would deny that liability is appropriate there. I think the issue becomes much more difficult when you start saying, well, the CCO could have done her job better, and so we're going to impose liability there. And I think that's something people have talked about, a wholesale failure of the CCO, but defining what that actually is difficult. And so I want to make sure that we're putting a framework in place that doesn't dissuade high quality, excellent CCOs from being CCOs in the financial industry, because they're concerned that if something goes wrong at the firm, everyone is going to point the fingers of blame at them. Things will go wrong, and that doesn't necessarily mean that the CCO didn't do her job in a way that merits an enforcement action by the SEC. It's a very delicate area, and I think there have been a couple of efforts by outside of the SEC, by groups outside of the SEC, to look at what an appropriate liability framework might look like. I think we ought to take a look at those frameworks and see if we can provide some more guidance.
Okay. In the SEC proposed the private funds rule last August, and at the time you said that the rulemaking is ahistorical, unjustified, unlawful, impractical, confusing, and harmful. So I wanted to ask you, how do you really feel about it?
Look, I think we got to the wrong place on that rulemaking. It's typical of our rulemaking approach these days, which is to propose very broadly and to pull it back from the proposal on the adoption. But you still have to look at the adopted rule and say, does that final rule, though narrower than the proposed rule, make sense? And my conclusion was it doesn't make sense, because it's a real departure from how we've looked at the SEC's role in regulating private funds in the past. And I think that has real consequences when we start to shift the attention of the agency to protecting investors who don't need our protection the same way that retail investors do, for example. And I think we opted for a regulatory framework that is looks to me much more like a retail framework than a sophisticated private fund framework.
Okay, the Supreme Court has decided to take on a case that reviews the Chevron doctrine, which is the longstanding precedent that grants deference to regulators when interpreting ambiguities in the law. If the Supreme Court overturns Chevron, how will that affect the commission and its work?
Well, I'm certainly no administrative lawyer, and what the Supreme Court does is certainly above my pay grade, I guess, or outside of my purview, certainly. But I think what we really need to be thinking about as regulators is, are we doing what Congress asked us to do? Are we sticking within the confines of what Congress told us to do? I spent, before I came back to the commission as a commissioner, I spent some time working as a staffer in the Senate. And I got a real appreciation for the importance of agencies adhering to directives from Congress. And so, for example, there are some things that some laws that when I was there on the Hill, I was not supportive of, and was thought that there were better approaches to take, for example, in response to the financial crisis. But as a regulator, my job is to do what Congress told us to do, and so that is something that I think we need to take seriously as regulators, and that means really hewing closely to what Congress put in the statute. And so, regardless of where the Supreme Court cases come out on points like this, that really needs to be our North Star, which is to really strive to figure out what it is the statute asked us to do, and to do that as faithfully as we can.
I just wanted to talk for a moment about the Financial Stability Board, or FSB, which is an international body that monitors and makes recommendations about the global financial system. And even though it doesn't have any direct regulatory authority in the U.S., its views are pretty influential and can signal future regulatory initiatives. And the FSB is particularly concerned these days about leverage in registered funds and private funds and the so-called non-bank financial institutions. What does the FSB's concerns mean for the SEC's future regulations? How does it view the recommendations of the FSB?
The FSB is an international body. They don't have jurisdiction over U.S. capital markets, and we can take into account the work that they do. They've done some interesting work, and that is something that we can factor in and think about. But ultimately, we as a regulator are not accountable to the FSB, and we again, as I mentioned before, we take our directives from Congress, and that's really important for us to do that. And it's important for us to maintain the really powerful role that U.S. capital markets play, not only in the U.S. but also in the world, and in financing the broader economy, and the value of having a vibrant capital market-centric financial system, I think, is evident in how historically successful it's been. So I don't want to lose that by turning our securities markets into something that looks like more like a banking model.
On that particular topic, a little bit closer to home, you have the Financial Stability Oversight Council, or FSOC, which just proposed rules that would make it easier to subject non-bank financial institutions, including mutual funds, ETFs, business development companies, and even money market funds, to prudential regulation. Where do you think this trend is going to lead?
Well, again, I think we at the SEC have a mandate that's different from the banking regulator's mandate. Our institutions are different, and they're different for a reason. We have a problem in this country with assuming that the government needs to bail out institutions when they run into trouble, but the institutions that we regulate are designed to be able to fail, and someone else can move in and take their place, and it's important that we preserve the ability of those institutions to fail, and then the people who made the decisions that led to those failures should bear the consequences. It's really important that we maintain that. So whatever happens with FSOC, I think maintaining the distinctiveness of the markets we regulate at the SEC is important.
Okay, well, and one other topic, regulation by enforcement. Do you have a sense that the Commission is trending toward regulation by enforcement, starting enforcement proceedings as a way of sending a message and, in effect, creating a new standard without having to go through the rulemaking process?
There's always a tension. If you have a regulatory framework and you want to have a principles-based framework, you don't always get the specificity in the rules that might help guide people. But I think that on the other side of that, you can end up using enforcement actions to send messages that would be better sent through writing a rule or writing guidance. We have gotten it wrong, I think, in many instances where we've used enforcement actions when we could have used one of these other methods. We are a regulatory agency, not a law enforcement agency. It's always important to remember that. That means that our objectives are, enforcement is one tool in the toolkit. It shouldn't be the tool that we instinctively reach for when we want to send a message to people. We should reach for some of those other tools that we have that can be quite effective. There is a time for enforcement, but I think we don't always get that. We don't always use the tool at the right time.
And sitting from your perspective, how do you think investors view the Commission and its work? And is that impression, if there is one, is it correct?
I think you need to talk to investors to understand what they think about the SEC. You know,
I'm talking about what you think their perceptions are.
Well, again, I talk to investors all the time, and I talk to some who are very dissatisfied with what the SEC does and others who are happy with what the SEC does. I think there's a spectrum of views, but what is important is for us to keep assessing what our regulatory agenda is and matching it up against our mission, which is facilitating capital formation, protecting investors, and ensuring the integrity of the marketplace, right? And that really has to be what we're measuring ourselves against. And it is important for us to listen when investors say something isn't working for them, and there have been instances where people have expressed concerns, and we need to take that into account and try to use, again, we too should be using technology better to communicate with investors. We should be thinking about ways that we can be a more effective regulator and serve investors better in helping them as they make their way through the securities markets.
Any other message you would like to send? That's the open-ended question.
Look, I think the message that is important to underscore is that we in the United States have a very special form of government, right? It's a government that's supposed to work for the people, not the other way around. And too often now, I think we forget that, and we forget what role government is playing. And so we end up with, and this is, I think, particularly valuable for us to think about this now when technology is becoming so powerful and it's enabling not only private industry to do a lot of things, but also government regulators to do a lot of things. So it's very easy for us to say, well, we can use these new technology tools to watch everything that goes on, everything that everyone does in the markets. And isn't that a wonderful thing? But that's where we need to check ourselves. We need to put in some brakes on how we are going to use technology to make sure that it's consistent with the government working for the people and not the other way around. So I guess that would be the area that I think it's really important for us to spend some time as a society talking about right now, because the technology really is, it's very impressively moving forward, and we need to make sure that we're putting the proper protections in place as we integrate that technology into what we do as a government regulator.
That's a good way to close, and we're here with Commissioner Hester Peirce of the Securities and Exchange Commission in Washington, D.C. Commissioner Peirce, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks, Jay, for having me.
This is Jay Barris of Sidley Austin with the Mutual Fund Minute.
This presentation has been prepared by Sidley Austin LLP and Affiliated Partnerships, the firm, for informational purposes and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. All views and opinions expressed in this presentation are our own, and you should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own jurisdiction. The firm is not responsible for any errors or omissions in the content of this presentation, or for damages arising from the use or performance of this presentation under any circumstances. Do not send us confidential information until you speak with one of our lawyers and receive our authorization to send that information to us. Providing information to the firm will not create an attorney-client relationship in the absence of an express agreement by the firm to create such a relationship, and will not prevent the firm from representing someone else in connection with the matter in question or a related matter. The firm makes no warranties, representations, or claims of any kind concerning the information presented on or through this presentation. Attorney Advertising, Sidley Austin LLP, 1 South Dearborn, Chicago, Illinois, 60603, 1-312-853-7000. Prior results do not guarantee a similar outcome.